You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hello there, I'm Chris Difford and welcome to the podcast I never thought it would happen, made in collaboration with the wonderful charity Help Musicians. In this episode I'm going to introduce you to a bloke who lives in my village. Indeed I am. Having finished music school, he hit the road with Julian Cope. He became a member of the Waterboys and then World Party. Before hooking up with an ex-boy band member, now I wonder who that could be. My guest has co-written with people like Diana Ross and Tom Jones, Texas and Mel C. The list goes on and on. I'm incredibly envious. He's probably the most successful British songwriter in the last 20 years. Please welcome Mr. Guy Chambers.
Hello.
Guy.
So sorry about yesterday, Chris.
Hey, Guy, that's fine.
I fell asleep.
That's okay. You're a musician. You're allowed to fall asleep. And of course, it's the oddest interview because you only live like 100 yards from where I am.
Correct.
And yet neither of us have got the technology to put two microphones together. That's weird after all these years.
When my studio's finished, it might be a bit easier.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. That's it. I will be able to do things like this in my studio, I'm sure.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you, what was the discipline of music college like for you? Was it something that you enjoyed? Was there a lot of camaraderie?
I felt like a fish out of water when I first arrived. Came down from Liverpool, and suddenly I was surrounded by lots of people from Southern England, lots of posh people, posh kids. So, and I wasn't a posh kid, and I felt, it took me a while in Guildford to feel at home. It wasn't until I discovered that they had a 16-track recording studio that I started to feel comfortable, to be honest.
Had you already been recording yourself by that point?
Yeah, there was a studio in Liverpool called Pete Studios, and I'd recorded a little bit in there. Done a little, but not much, just a little bit. But that's how I met Steve Power, who ended up being my co-producer for the Robbie Records.
Ah.
He was a young engineer in Liverpool when I was 15. You know, he was like 17, 18, and that's how I always... We still work together today, which is really nice.
That's a lovely thing, yeah.
It is.
Was he one of your closest chums then?
Not then. He became more of a close friend later on in life.
Right.
There was a guy called Steve Lovell who was in the first band I was ever in. He was the one who got me a job with Julian Cope after I left college. Julian Cope was in two of episodes.
Yeah.
And that was quite a big break, because once I got that job, I then got the chance to audition for the Waterboys, and then I got that job, and then I got the job with World Party. So literally, all of that was through Steve, really.
Yeah, I was talking to Steve Naive the other day, and he came straight out of music college into Elvis Costello's band. He didn't know what day it was for many, many years. You know, one minute he's studying music and the next minute he's studying all sorts of bad things, but having a lovely time doing it. going from music college to Julian Cope, wow, what a head spin.
Oh, it was. Well, the very first rehearsal with Julian Cope at John Henry's, which I'm sure you must have been in at some point in your career, in London, it's a very famous rehearsal studio. It's still there, amazingly. The very first rehearsal with Julian Cope, he was on an acid trip. And he didn't get off the floor for the entire rehearsal, apart from getting up and having a wee in the corner.
Oh, my God, yeah.
That was my first introduction to Julian. He didn't say hello when I walked in. he just ignored me. And the only comments I'd get from him would be occasionally, "That's the wrong sound on the Casio. It's the flute sound." just funny things like that. But he was funny, and but he did the entire rehearsal like that.
Wow. The only other person I knew that used to work like that is Kevin Ayers.
Who he is, but I've never come across him. But
yeah.
And then going to Japan on a tour with him for 10 days was really music business in the deep end. It was quite rock and roll, lots of drinking, lots of girls giving you presents. Yeah, it was an eye-opener. It was fun.
Were you frightened by it, or were you excited, like, this is what I've always wanted in my life?
Yeah, I think both.
Yeah.
Both. But I used to do affirmations when I was in Liverpool as a teenager. I used to imagine, well, being interviewed, exactly what we're doing now, and also being in a stadium. Playing in the stadium. So to me, it was just the beginning of what I believe would be a journey to a stadium. And of course, when I was 22, I had absolutely no idea how I was going to get to a stadium.
Yeah.
But I always believed that I would finally get there at some point.
Yeah, it's great when you're young and you have that kind of core belief before any baggage comes along, that ambition, you know. And for me, it was seeing The Who at Charlton, I just thought, you know, that's the job for me. I want to be on that stage. What kind of live shows did you go and see as a young man?
Well, I saw the first lineup of AC/DC with Bon Scott.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a complete game changer for me. They were the best band I'd ever seen up to that point. Well, that gig is in my top 10 gigs of all time. No question, even now. I can remember it. I remember Angus going around the venue with a wireless guitar situation.
Mm.
And this is in 1970.
Wow.
And I've never seen anybody do that before.
Yeah, that was real. Well ahead of its time.
It was. And they were just phenomenal, the show they put on. And so anyway, that was a big inspiration for me. And I suppose seeing Kate Bush was also a big one.
Mm.
I saw her live. Her opening show was at the Liverpool Empire, with her only English tour that she's ever done. I was lucky enough to be in that audience.
That's amazing.
And that made me realise that pop music can be theatrical.
Mm.
Her show was very theatrical, lots of guns.
Yeah.
It made me realise that it doesn't have to be just, you know, guitar based on this.
Yeah,
it was a real, it was incredible. And then, like, and then who else? Thin Lizzy, with the big background at Thin Lizzy. I saw them at least twice.
Ah, I once stayed at Phil Lynott's mum's house in Manchester.
Yeah.
That was quite an experience. She opened the door. It was like after we'd done a gig at like 1 o'clock in the morning or something. And she invited us in, and when she pulled back the curtain, there was like 30 people. They were mostly transvestites. And George Best was there.
Wow.
And the head of CID, Manchester. I mean, there was all sorts of... It was the weirdest night.
Yeah, I can picture it. Yeah, well, what a great band they were. And many years later, I had the same manager as Thin Lizzy, Chris Morrison.
Oh, yeah.
When the Lennon Tunes were born, he was our arrogant.
Wow, okay.
So I got to hear a few little bit of stories.
Was one of your affirmations to be on Top of the Pops at all?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. I mean, we both grew up with that. And as a family, we would, well, my dad wasn't interested, but he was a classical musician. He kind of laughed at pop music, really. He just thought it was all a bit of a joke. which you can argue it is.
Yes.
It was a dream for me. When I finally got on top of the pops with Robbie, that was a really big moment, as I'm sure it was for you when you first time.
So your first Top of the Pops was with him?
It was. It was in 1998. I had to wait a long time. I had to get on there.
Yeah. Who else was in the dressing rooms? What other bands were playing? Can you remember?
Yeah, I can remember Destiny's Child.
Oh, all right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I remember Beyonce. She was incredibly young then. But I remember her looking out of her dressing room door with the other two, flirting with Rob, trying to get his attention.
Wow, okay.
And he was like, oh, she's too young, I'm not going. I remember her vividly, you know, all three of them, and thinking, wow, they're just incredible. And I haven't been asked that question for a while. 1998 would have been maybe a band like Cast.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Something like that. Or maybe, I mean, I remember Jules Holland very vividly when we first did that. Mm. And that was with Radiohead.
Oh.
They were on the same bill as us.
Yeah.
And they were playing Paranoid Android. And I remember just thinking how bizarre this was. You know, 1 minute we're doing Angels or whatever song. I think we did the Nanny when we did Angels. And then they're doing Paranoid Android. I remember it being quite... But that was the great thing. Is Jules Holland still going?
It is, yeah. I mean, would you have preferred to hop across the stage and been in Radiohead for 15 minutes?
No.
No.
No, no, I know my lyrics. Although, funny enough, Colin Greenman, the bass player, got in touch with me. We have mutual tech friends, and he wanted to play with Robbie Williams for a while because he was fed up of playing Radiohead music.
Wow, that's interesting.
He wanted to play Let Me Entertain You, which I thought was... Yeah, it just shows you, it doesn't matter what band you're in, there's still going to be, as you so well know, there's going to be tension.
Yes.
Always. There's no band that's perfectly happy. That just doesn't exist.
That's so interesting, isn't it? That's the philosophy of... I think it's when you're young and you all have the ambition to do what... You get in the rowing boat and you all row together, and then somebody drops the oar and it goes around in circles for a few years.
That's right.
That's what it seems like to me. And then in the end, people are just chucking the oars away and that's the end of it. But, but you know, it's something that we can't get away from. It's kind of the foundation of who we are as writers and musicians. It's kind of what we do, in a way.
Yeah, well, I know with Radiohead, because a friend of mine's Nigel Godrich, and I said to him, I saw him recently, I said, when are they going to do another record? When are they going to do anything? And he said, well, the biggest problem is getting them all in the room at the same time.
Yeah.
And they don't particularly want to be in a room together at the same time.
No. I can imagine. And it was the same for REM, a band that I completely adored at the time. And, you know, Mike Mills came to one of our shows recently and we were discussing it. And he didn't want to discuss it. He said he didn't want to be in that space in his mind. He'd done so much therapy that that band didn't exist for him anymore. But he can afford to say that.
Yeah. Well, good luck. Well, well done him. It's interesting that it caused him that much trauma.
Well, yeah. But, you know, the way things have changed over the years is that I guess when we were younger, the idea of well-being, nobody knew really what well-being was and how to use that as a spirit level between the members of the band. That's the sort of education that I know that we can use now as we get older, but everybody has to be on board for that. So what's the difference between when you first started the Lemon Trees and with them now back on stage?
Well, it's a different band.
Right, okay.
The only original member is, say, Catelyn Birch.
Oh, okay.
Who was in the original band. I can't afford to play with the Stacey Twins. That's too expensive. That's too expensive.
Of course.
So I had young musicians in the band. Funny enough, I have another set of twins. They're called the Taylor Twins.
Mm.
And they played with the Mystery Depths. I don't know if you know that band.
Oh, very well, yeah.
Well, they played with them. And the drummer, Cap Stabini, is in the Mystery Depths. And Tiger Braun White is only 19 people there.
He's incredible, Tiger.
He is. So apart from me and Dave, the 2 6-year-olds, everybody else is in their friends and all, well, apart from Vibrate 19. And that's really nice. And I like that mix of generations. For me, that's really helpful.
Mm.
I wouldn't want the whole band to be in their 60s, really. Not least because as you get older, people tend to play louder. It's about, and I don't want that volume on my stage. Because with the Lemon Trees, there's an enormous amount of harmonies going on.
Yeah, melody. Mm.
Well, no, but backing vocals.
Yeah, yeah.
Doing blocks, doing like 3-part blocks. And I'm sure you know this as a fellow musician, that doing harmonies when the stage volume is loud is really, really difficult.
Mm.
I don't think the Eagles, for example, would have been very loud on stage.
I'd hope not.
I don't think so. They wouldn't have been quiet, but they wouldn't have been loud. You know, and so anyway, I know I really enjoyed. We did a gig the other day at Amazing Grace, which is a fantastic venue in London Bridge. So it's really great venue, and we had a really good time. And I can wish some more. But it's quite a big band, it's 6 of us.
Yeah.
So logistically, it's a bit tricky.
A little bit tricky. Yeah. Wow.
Hi there. I'm Beth Taylor. I'm a 30-year-old mezzo-soprano from and living in Glasgow, Scotland. I love to sing, go swimming, reading, eating cakes, and petting random cats in the street. I'm also thrilled and extremely proud to be one of the thousands of artists supported by Help Musicians. I have loved listening to classical music for as long as I can remember, in my granddad's sitting room, or indeed in his greenhouse where he did pottery. I didn't begin music lessons or singing lessons until far later into my mid-teens, but I did sing a lot at school. Even though I couldn't read music, I was so warmly encouraged by family, teachers, and as time went on, I think I realised that my love for music was just so deep. It was the only thing I would give my utmost attention and efforts to at school, and it was the one thing I was really celebrated for at school. It was what I was known for. Ah, she's the singer. And I kind of enjoyed that. It became a very strong identity. And when you're a teenager, having that identity is really important. I was worried at first when I finally realised this is what I wanted to do. I was so behind. As I say, I could barely read music. But if I think back to my final years at high school, I was still umming and ahhing about what I wanted to do and got myself into a right fret about it all. And I started writing to people, a careers advisor. And I wrote to one of my favourite musicians at the time, still is, the cellist Stephen Isselis. Now, I'm not a cellist, I'm not an instrumentalist, but I've always loved the way he engages his audience. And I thought, he seems like a really nice man. So I wrote him an email and I said, look, I'm terrified, but I want to do music. I don't know where to begin. I'm ready to study as much as possible to do it. And he wrote the loveliest response back. And he just said the words, if you feel like you have to do it, then there is no choice. And I thought, actually, yeah, he's right, there is no choice. Not only that, but I was determined to teach myself piano. I couldn't afford piano and singing lessons, so I got the exam books, and 1 year later I sat my grade 5 piano exam and I passed by 2 marks. But I passed, and I was really, really, really pleased for myself, just that I pushed and made it. So I did that, and then I gained a diploma with the Open University in music history. So this all very quickly snowballed, and before I knew it, I was offered a place to study at the RCS in Glasgow, 4 years undergraduate, and then I did 2 years master's. The highlight of my career so far I guess if I was to pick a moment that I was standing there with eyes looking and thinking, am I really doing this? It probably was the proms last year. I made two appearances for the first time at the proms. That was the sort of place that my grandfather, in the last sort of couple of weeks of his life, our final conversation was about music. Who was the greater composer, Schubert or Thalès? I don't know why. And we talked about places like the Royal Albert Hall. And I think that moment for me when I was standing there singing in this prestigious place, yeah, that was a moment I wish I could have just brought my grandfather back for the day and said, well, here we are. But I get quite emotional when I think about that moment when Help Musicians auditioned me for postgraduate study funding. There's kind of a funny story about that, if you don't mind me elaborating. I was working in Burger King. I was working at Cathedral. I was working as a music practitioner, as somebody who enables musicians who maybe require additional support to perform in mainstream music environments. And I loved that. Oh, I had little cleaning jobs. I worked in box office jobs. So I was coming to the end of my undergraduate. I hadn't quite received the funding that I was hoping for at the RCS, and my savings were a little bit low. So when I received the audition to apply for the Help Musicians Ian Fleming Postgraduate Award, I had an audition on the same day in Paris for an opera studio. But I thought, well, I'm in Paris. It's a quick flight to London. I'll make it work. So I did my audition in Paris at 9 a.m, then went to Charles de Gaulle Airport, and the flight was cancelled. So I phoned Help Musicians and they said, oh, the audition is only today. You've really got to get here if you can. So I was in a complete tizzy at the airport. I had a credit card with a like £300 limit or something. And I used it for the very first time to buy a Eurostar to London to get to this audition that was at 3 p.m. But then the Eurostar was severely delayed. So I phoned them again. They said, no, you really need to get here today. The panel will not wait any longer than 30 minutes. I don't think I've ever run so fast in my life from King's Cross. But I got there with about 10 minutes to spare before the panel had to leave. And the panel could not have been nicer. And immediately they made me feel very reassured that I was deserving of some financial support. And suddenly I could go to the conservatoire, able to focus on music and nothing else. Not only that, Help Musicians also reimbursed almost all of the travel expense I'd incurred from that emergency booking. I primarily work alone, but I wouldn't say that I'm not part of a team when I'm working with an orchestra and conductor, or an opera with a big chorus behind me, or a small cast. And the colleagues you work with, we all have a duty to be a good colleague to each other by being open and warm and responsive and being your honest self. You will get a lot out of that. When you need a wee bit of support, if you're feeling lonely. When my grandmother passed away at the beginning of the pandemic, I was in France, and those colleagues were absolute stars just for the couple of days I needed to get through the rest of rehearsals before I went to attend the funeral. As musicians, we are naturally quite resilient. I think you've got to be in this career. There are a lot of blows. And with those comes the opportunity to be strong and to recognise that we have more than one identity as a musician, but we are so many more things. Use technology to its fullest advantage. Call home. I have a dinner date with my partner whenever I can over video call. We try to like cook a similar meal, we light a candle, you know. All those things make a big difference. Your dieting and looking after yourself isn't easy, especially on tour. You're in a new place every day, finishing late at night. But I always have Tupperware with me, and I don't mind going to the supermarket and filling it up with a salad and whatnot. Getting out walking, being among people. I love reading. Sometimes I read books from home, places that are set home. It just takes me back for a few moments, and that can help a lot. I think that is exactly what Help Musicians do. They champion everyone. So watching their support through the pandemic, through Brexit, supporting musicians at all stages of their life and career, it's such a standout charity.
Help Musicians is a charity for working musicians across the UK. To find out more about the support they offer, why they do what they do, and how to support them in creating a world where musicians can thrive, visit helpmusicians.org.uk or find them on social media today.
I did read, in fact, that you're doing your own tour, which I'm really looking forward to, because I think the singer-songwriter tours are what people want, really. They want to know who you are, where you've been, and they want to be emotionally attached to you.
Well, thanks, Chris. Yeah, I'm doing solo piano tour in September. I think I'm doing about 8 gigs. And yeah, that's me playing the songs and talking about the stories. And also, I'm going to get somebody out of the audience and I'm going to write a song with them.
That's brilliant.
That's going to try anyway. I mean, but yeah, not a whole song, but like maybe a verse and a chorus.
Yeah.
And just see what happens. I've done it once before at the Bugle Festival. A couple of years ago, I did it, and it went really well.
Yeah.
So, but even if it doesn't go well, there's something in that.
Yeah.
People can have a good laugh.
Yeah.
At how someone who's meant to be really good at this isn't always good at it.
And what would you do if Robbie was in the audience and he got up and started to write with you?
Well, I just saw a pig fly through my window, Chris.
I think I just saw it fly by mine.
There's zero chance of that happening.
Yeah.
But okay, hypothetically, it would be great, because when we are in front of one another, there's definitely a chemistry there. Unfortunately, we haven't actually written in front of one another in the same room for about 4 years, something like that.
Yeah.
The last song we wrote together was in Military Wives. You know that movie?
Yeah.
We wrote a song for that film, which was commissioned. That's the last thing we did, I think, which is about... It might even be 5 years ago, actually.
Yeah, I remember watching one of his documentaries that was on telly, and there was a lot of home footage of you guys in exotic places around the world writing songs, and the closeness and the kind of camaraderie, friendship, whatever you had between you then was a really lovely to see. And that's hard to kind of manufacture. It has to come naturally. Are there people that you work with now where you find a similar kind of spirit?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm mentoring a young band called Hot Comb. In fact, they supported us the other day. That was their very first gig. And I'm working, writing with them. I definitely feel that camaraderie with them. It's just different. What I don't have, I suppose, is someone who was already a star. You remember that Rob, when I started working with him, even though he was in a really bad way when I first met him, but he was very famous. And I'm not working with anyone at the moment who was already very famous on a trajectory to where they could get even more famous. Like, I'm not working with a Kardashian, for example.
Yeah.
That would be the equivalent now, probably.
Yeah.
Like working with a Kardashian who wants to become a singer.
Yeah.
But I'm not doing that. I'm working with somebody who no one knows, a band that no one knows, and taking a risk on it. Because obviously, I'm not getting paid to do it. I'm doing it because I love them, and I want to help them. And hopefully, it will turn into something. But it's a terrible point.
Yeah. What does the music industry mean to them? You know, like when we were growing up, we couldn't wait to get a record deal and for A&R guys to come and see us, and now it doesn't matter anymore.
No, I disagree there. I do think it matters. Bands, well, not many bands are getting signed, but it does happen. I think this band could get signed. I think they've got all the right ingredients. I will get them in front of people at some point. They're not ready yet.
Yeah.
Well, actually, they're very close to being ready, but... their dream is to get signed. Their dream is to give up their day jobs. They've all got day jobs.
Okay, yeah.
They want to do music full time.
Yeah.
You know, I was very lucky because when I've never had a job.
Right.
Ever. I've never had a job outside music.
No.
I'm sure you're probably the same, aren't you?
No, I had several very dodgy jobs before I was... Okay. I worked in a... I was a solicitor's clerk for a year or two. Mm-hmm. And then I worked in a factory editing films together, but I didn't realise that they were porno films until the end of the first week when I got to see what I was editing.
Well, now.
And then I worked at Ready Mix Concrete. So I've had a few jobs. But that whole time in the background was like, let's get in a rehearsal room. Let's have the band. You know, I want to be in a band.
Well, that would have given you tremendous incentive to get out of that. And my incentive was... I didn't want to have any kind of job other than doing music. And that was my incentive. When I was very poor, and I had some very poor words, I would play piano in a pub. That was how I'd keep going.
Yeah.
Oh, I played at the Groucho Club when it first opened, for example.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, well, I would teach. I would teach the guitar. When I was a kid, I'd teach the guitar, football. Mm. So, yeah, I've always had that hunger to not have a proper job. Like, I've always had that lack of faith that I could ever really do a proper job, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I've limited capabilities, really.
I don't believe that.
Well, yeah, it's incredible at my age, but I feel I'm learning things more.
You do. Mm.
I'm getting a bit more self-sufficient now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good thing, you know, to be in that place, I think. The fragility of life sometimes can bring such great gifts. And yeah. I've had that throughout my life. I still am boss-eyed every morning wondering what's going to happen next. But, you know, with songwriting as a therapy and music as a therapy, it kind of helps. And I'm sure you must find the same thing.
Absolutely. I find writing very good. Somebody came up to me after Lennon Tree's gig, and he was a fan from 30 years ago, and he said that my album was one of his favourite albums of the 90s, and how much it meant to him, how I got it through. He still listens to it all the year. He was like a super fan, you know, I'm sure they meet them all the time. And that was just really nice, and makes you realise what a gift it is to be a musician when we have conversations like that.
Yeah, incredible. And your music throughout the years has lifted so many people. And, you know, with your optimism melodically is beautiful. And you must feel very proud of your catalogue, which is huge, of course.
Yeah, I don't think about it much. I'm practicing for a gig in Hastings I'm doing on Friday. Mm. I got to see some of my songs. And that when I actually have to sit down and learn them, it's when I realise, this song deserves to be sung properly and practice it. Yeah, I can't sort of do a bad Ocean of Angels. It's just horrible. So that's what I was doing before this morning. I was practicing Angels. And I'd never even sung it before.
Yeah, but it's your song. I mean, I know the same thing. You know, when I was first... led to the microphone after not being in Squeeze for a bit by my producer Francis Dunnery. I was so nervous because I just didn't know that I was always behind a great singer or two great singers with Paul Carrack as well. So for me to learn to sing my own songs was really hard, and I don't care whether they're not completely on the button because I now co-own those songs. And I'm sure you, once you sing those in Hastings, you must feel the same.
Well, we'll see how it goes. Let's see how it goes down. People probably might not necessarily enjoy my rendition, but they will like the preamble to it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the bit they probably really come for. And that, and lots of aspiring musicians giving me their CDs and their USB sticks.
Oh, God.
Or whatever. It's the bit I dread because I don't know about you, but James Blunt, for example, will never ever take any ideas of anyone because he doesn't want to get seen.
Right.
Because what he doesn't want someone to say further down the line with a new song, you ripped up my verse.
Oh, wow.
Remember I gave you that CD?
God.
It's just like track 2 of my CD. or Mike, you know what I mean? So he won't take anything from anyone. I would like to have that rule, really. I'm always a bit of a soft touch, but very, you know what it's like. It's hard enough keeping up your own music without having to think about all of these other people who are making music.
Yeah.
And giving opinions to people you've never met before about a hobby, basically. Pretty much everyone with Disney music are doing it as a hobby, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that, of course.
Yeah.
But for me to sit down and give it 4 minutes to listen to it and then to give it a couple of minutes to critique it, that for me is quite challenging. Obviously, I don't want to be mean, but also I want to be constructive.
Yeah, I have one in my inbox that came yesterday from, I don't know how this person got my email, but they sent me a song and I'm very reluctant to listen to it. Not that I'm going to write anything. I mean, as a lyricist, I don't write music particularly, so it wouldn't bother me. But he's looking for critique of his lyrics and that's so difficult.
It is. You know, it's different if you were a professor.
Yes.
At somewhere.
At Lipper.
And you were... Yeah, and you were paid to go and critique people's songs, and you have a completely different attitude to it. But unfortunately, I'm not moaning here, but so much of being a musician now, people expect you to do something for nothing.
Yeah, of course.
As in, critique my song for nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But actually, hold on a minute. I'm actually a professional musician. That's what, you know, I can't go to Waitrose on that.
No. No.
Well, not even Lidl.
No.
You know, but you have to advertise things, actually get, you know, money through the door, which I'm sure. And
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You work super hard in that direction.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to get distracted with stuff that doesn't earn all of it.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, I've just about to hit the front door of 6 months of touring with the band, and half of me is dreading it, and the other half of me is going to, well, actually, this is going to be great, and it's going to pay the rent and all that sort of thing, and going to get to see old friends and play on stage with great people and so on. Do you miss that kind of touring? Do you have an appetite for that?
No.
Good for you.
No, I did it for a long time.
You did, yeah.
Not as long as you, but I got bored. I got bored, and I think being bored and very dangerous for creative thought. So for me, it's very triggering more than...
Of course, yeah. But it's kind of... The way I look at it now is it's a bit like being in the theatre, because every night you're almost doing the same steps. You know, you could be Cliff Richard up there. You know, you're just doing the same thing every night, but to a different crowd. And that's a wonderful thing once you've got your head around it.
Yeah, but with the artists I work with, the talking part of the show became a really big part of the show. And I, to be a musician, also waiting for someone to talk, I understand why he wants to talk to his audience, and the audience love it. But to be a musician waiting 10 minutes for another monologue, it's just a bit boring.
Yeah. Well, Squeeze are completely the opposite. We don't talk at all. We just... It's like 15 seconds and then we're into the next song. It's like exhausting.
Well, that's a different kind of... That sounds too much the other way.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, I don't miss the boring. I love my home life, seeing the children wherever they want.
That's great.
I'm still traveling quite a bit. So I'm working with an artist, an Italian artist at the moment. I'm going to Italy a lot. Yeah, I mean, I still get to see interesting places.
Yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm. So actually traveling for months on end. You know,
yeah. Well, Guy, I want to thank you so much for being on this Help Musicians podcast. The Help Musicians is a charity that's been going for over 100 years. It was started by Edward Elgar. And the reason he started it was because a violinist friend of his died and the family didn't have enough money to bury him. So he clubbed together with a lot of classical friends of his and they raised the money to bury his friend. And that's how the charity began. And now they give to struggling musicians. And they also have a helpline for people that are struggling with just social life, I guess.
Good. It's amazing.
It's a pretty cool charity, really.
It is.
Yeah, and thank you for donating your time today. And I'll see you in the post office.
Okay, Chris. Thank you. Thank you so much. I enjoyed it. Bye. Bye.
See you later. Well, I wish Guy all the best with the solo gigs. They can be absolutely nerve-wracking, as I know, but they're very rewarding. And it's amazing that he's been the centre of Robbie Williams' life for pretty much all of the big hits that he had. That's quite an amazing feat. It's fascinating that a lot of his work is unknown, and I think mentoring young bands and young writers is definitely giving back. If you want to know more about the amazing work of Help Musicians, do them please take a little time to look at their website. Follow them on social media like I do. Spare a little of your hard-earned cash if you have any. And please consider donating a little money to the charity. As you hear in every episode, they do incredible work supporting musicians of all types across the UK. They really do change people's lives for the better. They've certainly changed mine, and it's been a very emotional journey speaking to so many musicians. Keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Gimme Sugar production for Help Musicians.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.